You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Home run, as I remember. This town gonna be here long after I'm gone. East side, west side, people don't surrender.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Our crazy Republican gubernatorial candidate, Golf Spikes! I'm going to talk about that a little bit. Also, the President's 60-minute speech, whatever that was with Leslie Stahl. Also, I was going to start off today talking about the journalist killed in Turkey. And I said, you know, what's going to come of it? We knew from the beginning that the Saudis had him killed. We knew from the beginning we were going to do nothing about it. Because, look, at the end of the day, we didn't do anything really to the Saudis after 9/11. So this journalist who's been, we now find out, evidently Trump believed that it was a rogue. It was rogue actors. There were, you know, outside actors. Because, you know, the king, you know, said it wasn't him. And look, the king's, you know, out there. So he doesn't know. But I found it interesting that Trump was, you know, playing the rogue actor line when eventually the Saudis said, yeah, it was us. We just interrogated him a little bit too hard, as if torture was better, as if torturing the guy to death was better than just when he walked in the door shooting him in the head. Somehow that works out a little bit better. So we'll see what happens with that. I don't expect anything to come of it. Which again, you know, because we're going to sell them guns, right? And we need their oil, right? So we'll talk a little bit about that. But I wanted to start today off on something that, you know, over the weekend, on Saturdays, we have our free speech TV program, our national TV program, which, you know, is in the homes of 40 million people across the country. And, you know, I had this moment to talk about, you know, the New York Yankees crossing a picket line in Boston where the Marriott workers were on strike. And, you know, look, you know, I call them the Skankies because, you know, they're scabs. I mean, if you cross somebody's picket line from you know, all of eternity, you will always be a scab to me because, you know, that's what scabs do. And I got a bunch of responses from people, you know, some positive, some negative, some, you know, yeah, go, you go pound sand, I'll cross whoever's picket line because it's all about me and that's all I care about. But I got a couple, you know, I got one that really, really, really stuck with me. Cynthia wrote me this really nice email. You know, she said, you know, I never miss your show. I watch it in honor of my father, who was an early and lifetime organizer for the UAW. She's 83 years old. And she says, I remember so much of it all. You were talking on the last show about how people are not standing together for the union. I think that is true, she says. I remember my father going out on strike to the picket line and coming back bleeding and bruised. She writes, the UAW struggle was much more violent than taught in colleges today. I got to tell you, Cynthia, I don't think it's taught in colleges or high schools or anywhere else. She says, I remember one time when I was very young and we lived in Detroit, my mother took me to a store for something that she thought important. The people who worked there were on strike. My mother was a sixth grade school teacher who taught 35 kids in Appalachia every day for $3,000 a year. The teachers' union had not come yet. At the picket line, she took my hand and whispered, don't tell your dad we're going through. At the time, everyone knew, everyone we knew worked in the plants. One man came up and spoke with my mother. Would you want someone to break your husband's picket line? He said. Just then, another striker called out to my mom, I know your husband. He said, don't do this. My mother took my hand and walked away. My dad told me once that the day that strikers let scabs go through their picket lines would be the beginning of the end of the union. Thanks for your great shows. I've learned so much from you about today's struggles. Love in solidarity, Cynthia. And, you know, I read that and I'm going, this is an 83-year-old woman who has seen so much in this country, has seen so much change. I mean, she's, you know, just a couple of years younger than my grandmother. And the stories that my grandmother and my grandfather used to tell me about, you know, the fight for the, you know, just dignity and respect on the job, the fight for the contracts that made their lives better. And, you know, we're losing that touch of knowledge. We're losing that piece of history. And I've often told the story of, you know, the woman I met in California with her mother. And, you know, this 30-year-old woman had no idea what unions were, had no idea what the Teamsters Union, who the Teamsters Union was, had no idea. And yet her mother said, you know none of this? Because her mother's uncle was an organizer with the rubber workers back in the 30s. The rubber workers were probably one of the top three or four most militant unions in this country. And this young woman had no idea that it even existed. And this is, you know, when I read a letter from this woman, 83 years old, who took the time to sit down and write, hey, you know what? Thank you. I remember this stuff. And this is what my dad told me, you know, 70 years ago. It resonates with me. And it's one of those things that, you know, the reason I tell the stories that I do, how I do, especially the things that my grandfather told me, is that we can't lose that connection to the past. We can't lose the connection of how what we take for granted today was built. Because understand, when 83-year-old woman back then, you didn't have, like she said, they didn't have teachers unions yet. Teachers were, you know, it was women's work, it was poverty wages, and it was something that women did on their way to getting their MRS. They didn't stay around long, and it was a constant turnover, except for the ones who didn't get married, and, well, they stayed forever. And the teachers took that and made it a solidly middle-class job by organizing. And this idea that, you know, crossing someone's picket line would be the end of the union is exactly what I've been saying for years. And there is no forgiveness for it. And this is where, you know, I come back to, you know, as a society, we have to remember what built that prosperous middle class, how it is that we had a working class that had the ability to have one income, still be able to afford, you know, to live in a reasonable accommodation, give kids opportunity to have a childhood instead of going into the mines or the mills or working in the fields and actually enjoy a bit of being a kid and actually going to school and bettering themselves and every generation getting better and better and at more opportunities. You know, we forget. And it's easy to forget that 8, 9, 10-year-old kids were working and dying in the mills, were dying in the mines. You know, I remember reading a story a couple of years ago about this young girl. She was like 9 years old, spitting up blood in the looms. because of the stuff in the air from the thread. And it would just shred your lungs and shred your throat. And it was horrible. And yet, because people fought for on-the-job protections, because people fought for safety, a voice, something, we don't have that. Now it's what goes on in China. But they give them little masks, so it's better now. So when I read this, it was just one of those things that I go, you know, this is where I have to start. Because, you know, this is the building block of everything else. Everything else starts for me, you know, I don't care if you're a Democrat, a Republican, independent. You know, someone asked me what I am. I said, I'm a green conservative liberal libertarian. If it's a good idea, it's a good idea. I don't like giving, I certainly don't like ceding fiscal responsibility to conservatives because they haven't shown that they deserve the title. I certainly don't like to give family values to Republicans because they certainly haven't shown that they believe in family values. I think those are good ideas. I think they're things we should pay our bills. We should treat our family with the utmost respect and dignity and love and affection and all of that. And other people's families too. See, that's the other part of this. But it comes back to this building block, this fundamental building block of, as a society, will we stand together to push for, you know, on the job, better wages, hours, conditions, in society, you know, those things that make us aspire to be better, you know, better human beings, better citizens, better Americans, you know, just better people. Will we do that? Or is it really just all about hooray for me and screw everybody else? I mean, that's the thing that got me thinking. And look, I got a bunch of emails from people who were saying, oh, you know, that scab thing, that was a thing of the past. You know, that's we don't need that anymore. We don't need that kind of division. Yes, we do. And as I've said before, there was a guy who lived catty corner from my grandparents who nobody ever talked to. And my grandfather threatened to beat me if I ever played with his grandkids. Because like 50 years earlier, he had crossed a railroad strike picket line. That's how you hold people accountable. Because once you start down this path, and Cynthia is absolutely right, her father was right. Once you start allowing people to cross your picket lines and not be held accountable, once that happens, it's over. Because what the wealth class has done masterfully, and they've always done this masterfully, they've always been able to slice and dice and pit people against one another. You know, Jay Gould, the famous railroad magnate, is often credited with the quote, I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. And that's true. You look at these people who are willing to cross someone's picket line in the light of day, because they know there's nothing to hold them accountable. And there's something wrong with that. And as a society, maybe this younger generation, maybe they're going to be the ones who stand up, step forward, and speak out, and begin to do that. Maybe. You know, we'll see. But Cynthia, thank you so much for the email. This is someone that, you know, I would love to, you know, sit and just pick her brain, because, you know, I love hearing about those battles and the sacrifices that, you know, people who history will never remember. The average everyday working person who took to the picket line, who went on strike and put their family in peril so that they could make things better for tomorrow. Those are important stories. You know, and something just popped into my head. You ever see if you've ever watched the movie Hoffa, there's a scene in there where it was a fantastic scene. The RTA bus strike is going on in Cleveland, and, you know, all the people with Hoffa are marching in, and we're gonna demand, you know, better wages. We're gonna demand better, all this stuff, and, you know, they're all there rallying in front of the RTA building, and the bosses are standing up in the window looking down on them with the police chief and a bunch of, you know, bigwig official types. And they're all looking down as, you know, the throngs of workers are saying, you know, hey, we want, you know, we demand better wages. And all of a sudden, the doors all around these people just fly up, and a bunch of people with bats and axe handles come out and just start pummeling the crowd. And there's this melee of human, just, you know, people just beating each other senseless. And you can't even tell who's on which side. There's just people, I'm sure, you know, people on both sides were beating each other. It was just this massive humanity of, this massive mall of humanity. And the people in the window are watching, and all this stuff, and things are burning, and cars are being tipped over. And they just close the window and turn their back and go back to their conversation. That's how much power they have. And the thing is how do we make sure that that doesn't happen, that we don't allow ourselves to be used as pawns that end up in that situation? Just my thought. I'd love to hear yours, though. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, to talk to an author about a great new book out. You know, as we were saying a couple of days ago, the state of Pennsylvania is trying to move away from high-stakes standardized tests. What does the future of education look like? Will we see another move towards corporatizing? Will we see something a little smarter? I don't know. So when we come back, we're going to talk with Joel Feldman about his book, The Grading for Equity. This book right here. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
There's nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win.
On The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 2010. That was the day 33 Chilean miners were finally pulled to safety after being trapped for 69 days. Workers had been mining copper and gold 2,300 feet down at the San Jose mine near the northern city of Copiapo when the mine caved in early August. The company waited several hours to notify authorities, and rescue efforts only began 2 days later. Trapped miners initially tried to escape through ventilation shafts, but found the required ladders missing. Each route they attempted was blocked by fallen rock or threatened additional collapse. A state-owned mining company took over the rescue efforts, and soon they began. As geologist Serena Sorensen noted, prospecting for people. Initial exploratory boreholes failed to locate miners because mine shaft maps had never been updated. Rescuers had no idea whether miners were even still alive. Finally, 17 days later, the eighth borehole reached them. The miners tapped on the drill and taped notes to it, alerting rescuers above that they were indeed alive and well. Food, medicine, and other supplies were lowered down to them as rescue efforts intensified. Many cameras were also lowered down, and miners videotaped messages of their continued ordeal. They told how they continued to search for possible escape routes and agreed to ration their limited food supplies so they could all survive. The first of three drilling plans to free the miners began. It was an international effort. The Chilean Navy consulted with NASA to design and construct the rescue pods. Throughout the entire process, rescuers worked to prevent additional cave-ins and rock falls. Finally, the extraction process began, and in less than 48 hours, all miners emerged as heroes.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
He's going the distance. He's going for speed.
So as we've talked about over the years, we opted our kids out of the standardized tests, you know, all the high stakes standardized tests. We said, no, we're not playing that game. We're not going to have our kids used as statistics, as a way to destroy public education. Now, as I told the kids, I'm not against testing. In fact, a big fan of testing. In fact, when I was a kid, we had a test every Friday. So that on Monday, you figured out what you didn't know Friday, you got to work on for the next week. So eventually, you learned the material and you did better. I'm all in favor of that version of testing. But this idea of having one huge 2-week-long test where at the end of it you don't get the results for several months and there's no diagnostic kind of help for the kids just seems stupid. And here the state of Pennsylvania agreed with me and has kind of moved away from these Keystone exams as a measure of graduation. They're now adding a couple of other things, a couple of other avenues for kids to be able to choose. Instead of having this one one big giant looming test. And you know, as I began to say that, I think we're coming near the end of the high stakes testing, as well the know all, do all, be all of, you know, as George Bush said, is our kids learning? I still love that. And the question is, what comes next? Because understand, there will be something next. Will it be something worse or will it be something better? I don't know, which is why we've asked Joe Feldman to come talk with us. He has written the book, Grading for Equity, what it is, why it matters, and how it can transform schools and classrooms. Joe, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Good to be here.
So, you know, as I said, you know, the whole high stakes testing regime, I'm hoping is coming to an end. You know, slapping labels on kids as failures because they didn't know the answer to a question that they were never exposed to always seemed kind of stupid to me. So it seems like now's a good time to talk about where do we go from here. So explain to me, what is grading for equity?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think as we see the weight of standardized tests fade a little bit, it leaves us with a question, which is how are we going to know what students know? And it places a lot more emphasis on the grades that they get. For 20 years, I was a teacher, a principal, a district administrator, and something that always nagged at me was that you could have two teachers, let's say they both teach ninth grade algebra, and they'd be in the same school and maybe in classrooms next to each other, and they have the same textbook and the same training and the students are similar, but one teacher might have 10% of their students failing and the other could have 50% of their students failing. And I realized that it's because of how they grade. And that's not right. We want the grade to reflect what students know, not how the individual teacher grades them.
Right.
And the more I researched, the more I saw that, well, teachers aren't getting any training in how to grade, and they're not getting any support in sort of knowing how to do that equitably and with mathematically sound formulas and things like that.
So it couldn't just be that, you know, the one who's failing 50% of the kids, they're just bad teachers and we need to get rid of them.
No, it's not that. I mean, we saw that they had the same training. I mean, what's happening is that teachers are doing grading sort of on their own in isolation, and they're doing it differently. And unfortunately, they're including a lot of bad practices in the way that they grade.
Give me an example.
So a teacher will grade a student on their effort. And oftentimes, effort is just the teacher's biased perception.
That's subjective.
That's right. And it's usually a projection of what looks like effort for the teacher. You know, whatever I do to show effort, I'm looking for that in my students, and I give them points if I see it. Unfortunately, students come in all kinds of different backgrounds and cultures, and learning looks a whole lot different ways. And so when they embed effort into the grade, they start warping what the grade means.
Yeah, I'd never heard of that one. I mean, when I was, you know, look, I went to school a whole long time ago. You know, you handed in your homework. Each homework assignment was worth X amount of points. You turned it in on time. You got those points. You didn't. You got half or you got nothing. Your test was what it was, and it was just a numbers game when I was in school. I don't remember any of the subjective stuff of you know, how much effort did you put into it or any of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, what often happens with homework is when they give points, like the one you're describing, the way you're describing it, is that homework becomes this proxy for privilege. So the kid who has two parents at home, both college educated, is able to get a lot of support when they do their homework. But the kid who has a single parent who's working two jobs and the kid who has to take care of their siblings, and, you know, they're not able to complete homework as readily. And so they get penalized, even though they may still be learning just as much in class and demonstrating that on the test. And so by including all those other kinds of things that really don't have anything to do with the learning kids do, it starts making the grades more inequitable.
But what do you say to the person, you know, because, you know, I've heard this argument before. What do you say to the person who says, well, you know, we're training these kids, you know, to be, you know, the future worker bees, and, you know, showing up on time is an important lesson that kids, look, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. We were at the bottom, and I got to go to Catholic school, and the nuns used to beat us if our homework wasn't on time. So, you know, the beatings taught me, you know, you got to be on time, and I'm still on time for everything. So it was kind of a solid working class ethic that you're teaching, you know, timeliness.
Yeah, and I'm not saying don't give feedback and don't have consequences if students are late. I mean, they need to learn to be on time. But to include that information in a grade starts changing the accuracy of the grade. You know, if I do A-level work, but I handed in a day late, so I get a B. That B looks like the same B that someone got for doing B-level work handed in on time. And when you have two kids who have the same level of learning, but one handed in late and one didn't, and they have the same grade, it starts making grades very unreliable, and it makes it hard to know what to do with the grade. And at the same time, we use grades for all these major decisions that we make about kids, whether they get to graduate or get scholarships or whether they're promoted or which academic track. And so when we have grades that have lots of sort of bad practices embedded in them, we have to take a step back and say, wait a minute, is there a better way to do this?
Yeah, and there's always some bias. I remember back when I had taken a high school English course, and a friend of mine was one of the top students in the class. I obviously was not. We switched our names on papers that we had done, and he got the paper that I wrote that he put his name on. He got an A, and I got a C+ on the paper that he had written with my name on it. It was one of those things where we joked that she probably just threw it on the stairs, and it just landed on the stairs that way.
Yeah, we all have stories, I think, of the teacher who does something that just seems grossly unfair. But overall, teachers are really trying to do their best work.
And sure.
Grading is, what I call the last island of autonomy. That's all they've got left when all the different mandates and all the district initiatives and state and federal, they can still control their grade. And so with that control comes a lot of responsibility and more learning. And, when I share this with teachers and help them learn how they're grading in a pretty inequitable way, they get all upset. And then they start realizing, I actually want to do better. I actually think this is going to be better for kids.
No, and that's hopefully where this goes. I mean, because as I've heard, it's the ideas that are lying around when change happens. So having something like this, for people to look at, I think is not a bad thing. So how do you plan on rolling something? How would something like this roll out? How do you envision this playing forward?
Yeah, so I think that it really needs to come from the teachers. I think when districts try and mandate a policy like don't grade homework, it just is a disaster. And so it really requires it to rest within the teachers to start trying these practices and then see the results. And when we do this with teachers, I've tried these practices out with hundreds of teachers over the last 5 years, and they all say it's just transformed the way they teach their class. And it's really, it's an opportunity for parents also. I think that because you and I were graded in a certain kind of way, when we go to parent-teacher conferences, we expect that that's how we should continue to have our kids graded.
Yep.
But it's really, it's incumbent upon us to think about grades differently and to be part of the conversation with teachers.
No, I agree, because I think about our kids in the school district we're in. They don't even give grades, really. I mean, they get P's and M's and all of this for the first couple of years, and you go, I don't understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm used to the old A, B, C, D, and F.
Yeah, and I think we're gonna have that for a long, long time, and certainly when they get to middle and high school, that's the predominant way that kids are graded.
Yeah, I mean, so the question then becomes how does this all work then? I mean, because as I was looking through some of the material, it seems like a mathematical equation. Explain to me how it works out.
Yeah, so one of the things is that we want to use sound mathematical formulas. So if a student does really poorly at the beginning and then does very well at the end on a particular standard or particular content area, then normally what happens is you average the performance. That's how grade books work. That's how teachers average the work a student does. So if I didn't know something and got an F on it at the beginning and then later I got an A, that averages to a C. And so that actually is not the right way to describe how I did. No mathematician would say, oh yeah, take the lowest and the highest and average them. They would say, well, if the student knows how to do it, give them the grade that shows they know it. So it's not rocket science, a lot of this, but it becomes really empowering for teachers to think about their work differently.
Interesting. So let me get this straight. So if at the beginning, I just totally bomb out on this, but as the semester goes on, I really grasp the concepts and I get it at the end, you're not going, because I remember being average. I mean, your grades just were what they were at the end. They tallied it up. They gave you a number and bang, that's what you got. So are you saying that, towards the end it's graded, it's weighted heavier towards the end, or
that's right. Because think about it. If you have think the summer before your ninth grade year, one student goes to a university summer program and learns how to write a great essay. And so they come in on the first day of ninth grade, and the teacher wants to teach them how to write an essay, and they write an incredible essay from day one, and they keep writing great essays all through the semester. And then you have another kid who wasn't able to go to this summer program and had to work all summer, and so they came in, and they have no idea how to write an essay. And so they bomb it, and then over the course of the semester, they write just as well as the first kid. Well, why wouldn't we give that kid the same mark as the first kid? The kid learned what they were supposed to learn. What do you want from him?
Interesting. I mean, it's an interesting concept, and not one I had really thought of.
Well, and it's how we think about lots of things. When you think about, you know, how what's a runner's time when they run a race? Well, you don't average their times for the last year. You say, what's the speed of the race they just ran? So I think there's lots of ways to just, it's not rocket science, but it's asking us to challenge sort of this foundation of our schooling and assumptions that we've made about how we describe how students are doing. And once we start thinking of it differently, it makes a whole lot of sense, and it motivates students. You can imagine the student who does a terrible job on the first essay and the second and the third, they're going to say, forget it, I can't ever write an essay. But now, if they have the chance, no, it's actually, how do you do at the end? They're going to be a lot more motivated to learn and be successful.
And to stick with it, if they do bomb at the beginning, because I know, especially when I was in college, you know, there were classes at the beginning where you just go, you know what, I'm never going to catch up.
Yeah.
And we would just withdraw. You know, there was a certain, you had the withdrawal date. I bombed the first test. I'm moving on. So this would actually have probably kept me engaged for the whole semester.
Yeah, that's right. And teachers talk about that. They say that kids aren't giving up like they used to because they're not consigned to failure for a few early mistakes.
It's interesting. Now, I'm reading through this book. I'm looking through it, and it looks like it's a college textbook. It doesn't look like it's something that you would sit down and you know, do some enjoyment reading with. Is that who you wrote it for? Is this the plan here?
No, it's really for a much broader audience. I mean, primarily it's for teachers. And as when they read it, all these things will resonate with them very clearly, as well as with principals and district administrators and board members. But it's also, I'd organize the book so that people can actually skip around. So the beginning is very much sort of a storytelling style. And then you can find the aspect of grading that interests you or that you feel is something that's been going on with your child that you feel that just doesn't feel right, and you want to be able to go in and email the teacher and say, hang on, why are you having so many extra credit assignments? Like, I can't afford to do the extra credit assignments, or this doesn't seem right to judge my child on their effort or participation. And it equips people to be able to have these kind of conversations that will create more equity in our schools.
Yeah, I mean, it's already got me thinking about, you know, some of our kids and, you know, some of those things that are going on. Because the school that my kids go to, they don't do an awful lot of homework. When I was a kid, you know, again, you know, we walked up, you know, uphill both ways, knee deep in snow, you know, 365 days a year. But still, I remember I used to come home, you know, 2-3 hours homework a night was not unusual, you know, in Catholic school in the 1970s. So,
yeah.
You know, they don't have near the homework that I expect they should have had or that they actually do have.
Yeah, and I don't come down on either side about whether to have homework or not. My argument is that if you're assigning homework, don't include a student's performance on homework in the grade, because A, you never know who's doing the homework. It could be they could be copying it, they could be getting a lot of help, who knows? And so you don't want to give the student points for that when you don't know who's done it. And the second thing is that you want homework to be a place for students to make mistakes. And so if they make mistakes there, then you don't want to take off for that, because where else are they going to make mistakes except for homework? That's where they're supposed to practice.
Yeah, so it's
just kind of turning the lens on all of this to have us look at these things a different way.
Yeah, and I would have to think that, you know, if there was some consistency, because I had never really actually thought about that there was more than one way to grade, you know, a student on a whole bunch of different things, as you pointed out. You know, to have some consistency and transparency might not be a bad thing, especially as teachers really, I don't know how you feel about it, but I see teachers as constantly under attack and under assault, not just by lawmakers, but by society as a whole. So, you know, I don't see this as a bad thing.
Yeah, that's right. And it's actually very empowering for teachers. I think it gives them the opportunity to take a lot more control and ownership over the way that they describe how students do. Many of teachers are so overwhelmed, and they just kind of, you know, with all the pressures placed on them, it's, they replicate how they've been graded. And as I said, unfortunately, every teacher is doing it slightly differently. One's taking off for late work, another's not. One's giving lots of extra credit. One's not giving any. One's allowing retakes. And so it creates a lot of confusion for the students, first of all. And it then creates a lot of confusion and I think undermines the profession a little bit in the eyes of external people, right? The people who want standardized tests point to grades and they say, look, it's so variable and idiosyncratic. But yeah, we need standardized tests. That's the only way we're going to know how well kids do. And so I think it's a real source of empowerment for teachers to take back the ownership and authority that and the professionalism that I think they have.
And you don't think this is something that should be done district-wide or even in a school building, you know, to kind of have uniformity? Because, you know, as you were talking there, I'm thinking, you know, we've had a bunch of very, look, I like all of my kids' teachers. I think they're dedicated professionals who really care about the students, you know, and our kids and all of that. But, you know, you've seen wide variations on, you know, like you said, some give extra credit, some don't, some give a lot of extra credit. So, you know, there are those differences among, you know, different classes, different, even, you know, within the same grade, you know, being from one side to the other, because they do this thing where they split the class in half. It's I hadn't really even thought about it.
Yeah, and the good thing is that teachers who have used these practices through the work I've been doing for the last 5 years, they start to get some coherence around it. So they all start to agree, oh, right, extra credit is not a good thing, and it creates inequities, and we shouldn't grade on participation, and we shouldn't grade on effort. And the more they work with each other and try out these practices in their classroom, the more coherence and consistency that they get. And my point was not that a school shouldn't take this on, but it shouldn't be the principal who says, hey, I just read this book, no more extra credit. That is a recipe for all kinds of bad things to happen. But instead, give teachers the opportunity to work on this together as a team in a school or in a whole district. And after trying these things out, they'll find that lots of great things happen. When we've done this, we've seen D and F rates go down. Grade inflation also goes down because kids aren't getting all the points for all the fluff. And even though I'm, as I said, I'm not a huge fan of standardized tests, what we're finding is that the grades that teachers are assigning are getting more strongly correlated with the test scores kids get. And while, again, I'm not a huge fan of standardized tests to answer all the questions, I think that I'd rather have the grades be more closely correlated to the test than farther away.
Yeah. I agree. Again, the book Grading for Equity, What It Is, Why It Matters, and How It Can Transform Schools and Classrooms, written by Joe Feldman. You can check out the website, gradingforequity.org. We'll make sure we get links out. I hope people will pick up a copy. Give it to your teacher. I know I'm going to give my kid's teacher my copy, and maybe it'll start a revolution of changing how grades are done, Joe.
Great. Thanks a lot, Rick. I hope so.
I appreciate the time. Thanks so much. Again, gradingforequity.org, the website, the book written by Joe Feldman. Highly, highly suggest taking a look at it. It got me thinking about things differently. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon solidarity. Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood. The list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1990. That was the day that President George H.W. Bush signed the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. Worker safety at the Nevada nuclear test site had been sacrificed during the Cold War era, as the United States rushed to keep pace with the Soviet Union's nuclear arsenal. The result was an increase in cancers, including leukemia, from workers being exposed to deadly radiation. For more than a decade, these workers tried to get Congress to
to pass legislation for compensation for radiation sickness. Uranium miners from states including Nevada, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Wyoming also joined the effort, filing a suit against the government. The courts ruled against the workers, ruling that national security needs trumped the safety of workers. Democratic Representative Wayne Owens from Utah sponsored a bill to give the workers compensation. In a statement carried by the New York Times, Representative Owens called the bill, quote, an apology to those people and their heirs on behalf of the government and the American people that were subjected and sacrificed for the Cold War nuclear weapons. President Bush explained the scope of the act at the signing ceremony, saying, quote, the bill provides compassionate payments to persons with specified diseases who fear that their health was harmed because of the fallout from atmospheric atomic testing at the Nevada test site. Regardless of whether causation can be scientifically established, the bill entitles each person meeting specific criteria to a payment of $50,000. Uranium miners meeting separate criteria will be entitled to compassionate payments in the amount of $100,000. The bill established a $100 million fund for the workers and residents who lived downwind of the Nevada test site.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you know, I've been following this guy on Twitter. Calls himself a Christian prophet. Again, one of these way out religious, you know, radical types that evidently has a pretty good sized following. His name's Mark Taylor, otherwise known as the Firefighter Prophet. Evidently, he believes that the Democrats control the weather. Evidently, the Democrats are the ones who are raining hurricanes down on the East Coast just because they're mad at Donald Trump. Now, so, you know, hey, you know, if the Democrats could, if they could control the weather, do you think that, you know, they would do it against Trump? Well, hey, maybe they can. Maybe Bill and Hillary have a secret lab in their basement where they control the weather. Anyway, let's find out what's going on around the world and in Washington, D.C. Bob Ney, Talk Media News. Bob, thanks for taking time for us. So what do you think? Do you think if the Democrats, do you think they control the weather?
Well, I don't know. If they do, then they ought to make it, they got to make it, what is it, rain on Election Day? They want sunshine, right? Yes.
Yeah, you want more people showing up.
Right. So if they control it, then they should make sunshine.
No, they can't make sunshine. They can only make rain, and they can only do bad things. Because if I get this right, if I get his premise right, Democrats can only do really horrible things.
Mm-hmm. And who is this? I've never heard of him.
His name's Mark Taylor. Just a guy I came across as, you know, and there are a bunch of these right-wing attention getters. You know, they're trying to make a name for themselves in the very lucrative, cash-rich evangelical world. So they're trying to, you know, be as far out there as they can be so that maybe the kooks will send them money. I mean, because that's how it is. You know, the evangelicals, you know, the way to God is through evidently his bank account.
You never know.
I've always found it very fascinating that, you know, people send money to people on TV. You know, I used to watch that Tammy Faye and Jim Baker, still on TV. And I used to marvel at the fact that there were people who would send these charlatans money.
Right.
I just, you know, who was the guy who threatened that God was going to kill him if he didn't raise, you know, like $10 million or something?
I don't know.
Was it Oral Roberts?
Pat Robertson.
It was one of them.
Pat Robertson used to do a lot of stuff.
It was one of them where, you know, on the at the last minute, in came a massive donation, and it was God's will. And you know it was him trying to save his own skin. So, I don't know. Anyway, so hurricanes. If it's not the Democrats, who is it? Because Donald Trump doesn't believe it's us.
Yeah, but you mean Hurricane Michael?
Or any hurricanes. He doesn't believe in... did you get his climate change thoughts during that 60 Minutes interview?
Well, what he was saying, which was interesting, and now I'm not sure this ties in, but I'm going to think it does. NASA, which of course President, points the head of NASA and directs it. NASA has data out today about a severe climate problem, and that's NASA.
Right.
So that's our own agency of the government. And Trump, of course, which I found fascinating, doesn't mean he's going to embrace doing something, but I found it fascinating that he said it's not a hoax. Now, of course, he said that before, that it's a hoax, but now, he's backed away from that, which is just interesting.
A huge step forward.
That he wouldn't hold to the hoax part. But again, that doesn't mean that we're going to be back in the Paris Accord. I think part of the problem with all of this has been, and going back to the Kyoto Treaty, is how to get the entire world in it, moving and doing all the same things. Now, some of the third world countries, for example, wanted money to help them. I understand that, but then again, India, for example, is 1.2 billion people. It's such a large population, it's impossible to pay for everything. But I think big key will be, first of all, to recognize it's not a hoax. There is a problem. Everybody can argue all day long, as you know, Rick, what the problem is. There is some problem out there. And so then they've got to find an equitable way that the world, for the most part, the major players of the world become involved.
No, I think we're all screwed.
I just thought it was interesting. I think it was, also population. Nobody can argue, make me think by argument that, this population, at the time of Christ, there was 100 million people, and Mother's 95. When he was a kid, I think there was, 1.7 billion? Now there's 7 billion. We can't keep sustaining this kind of growth and usage of products and materials and burning things, et cetera.
No, I agree with you. In fact, we got a guy running for governor here in Pennsylvania who believes, he believes the climate is changing, and it's man-made because there are too many of us. It's our body heat that's doing it. There are so many of us that we're just heating up the planet naturally. It's the same guy. It's the same guy. And I don't know if you saw the video of Scott Walker or Scott Wagner. I keep saying that.
Oh, yeah. I know who you're talking about. Okay.
Yeah, this guy here, right here.
Well, Governor Wolf, let me tell you, between now and November 6th, you better put a catcher's mask on your face, because I'm going to stomp all over your face with golf spikes, because I'm going to win this for the state of Pennsylvania, and we're throwing you out of office, because you know what? I'm sick and tired of your negative ads.
He's sick and tired. And golf spikes! Golf spikes, Bob!
Man, that's interesting.
There's a guy who needs an intervention quickly.
That's interesting.
He wants to be Trump. I mean, he's a little Trump wannabe. He's a fairly wealthy businessman who feels entitled to be governor. And he spent a boatload of his own money running probably the worst campaign I've ever seen. And, he now feels a little angry. And he came out with a video, said, the pressures of the campaign and all this. And I'm going, hey, dum-dum, what do you think the pressures of actually being governor are going to be like? Is this how you're going to, maybe strangle some of the legislature?
Well, you're right. He's trying to be Trump. There's times and places for things, whether they make sense or they don't. And, John Kasich, I've known him forever, his entire, political life. And John Kasich could tend to be abrasive, okay? All of a sudden, I was like telling a friend of mine, and I don't mean this in a mean way, but he became Mr. Rogers during the primary. And all of a sudden, Trump was Trump. And whether it was, crass or whatever, obviously what Trump was doing was working in the Republican primary.
Yeah.
People were, tired and wanting this and wanting that. And being the nice guy might have worked the previous one. It just didn't work the last time. But now people try to, isn't it funny how they try to imitate things?
No,
but
absolutely. I mean, they all want to be little Trump wannabes. Now, this guy's always been a bully. He's somebody who, at one point he was at a dinner and said, there's going to be blood on people. There's going to be bloodshed. And he gets out these surgical gloves and he goes, I'm going to be in it, but I'm not getting blood on my hands because I got gloves. You go, what the hell is that?
Wow. Wow.
He's a guy who routinely snatches cameras away from cameramen at functions. I mean, he's in the hallway of the Capitol because he was a state senator before he resigned. He put up little iPhone cameras around his door to see who was knocking over his sign. I mean, the guy's just a lunatic. And I'm hoping he gets crushed in this election. And maybe we don't ever have to hear from him again. Just beyond bizarre. But anything else from the 60 Minutes interview that caught you off guard? Maybe we're going to start up, snatching babies again?
Well, I think, for the most part, President Trump kind of behaved himself to a sense. You know what I'm saying? That, I don't know, he doesn't do 60 Minutes. He doesn't do shows like that much. But I think he kind of tried to get a certain demeanor out there that was not as kind of wild. So you didn't get as many reactions. Although, to me, what caught my eye was he started to backtrack on Jamal Khashoggi from what he said 2 days previous. Tried to get a little bit more, we might have to do sanctions, et cetera. But otherwise, Trump's Trump, and I thought Leslie Stahl did a decent job with questions.
Yeah, I mean, I thought he came off as really, more confident than I've seen him. And to steal Van Jones' line, he almost looked presidential.
I think he was told, that you've got to be careful on this one, and he just had a different demeanor than you normally see.
Yeah, I mean, for me, what caught my attention was the climate change little bit there.
Right.
And also the, maybe not, maybe who knows, maybe we're going to start snatching babies away from families again. Those are the two things that jumped out at me. The rest of it, I thought, was, fairly predictable.
When I'm the president, you're not.
Yep. the same kind of, bravado you would expect from him, and you got it. Not surprising. But the Khashoggi thing is interesting to me that, even today he came out, and, I talked about this earlier, even today he came out and said, well, it could have been a bunch of rogue actors. Who knows? I talked to the king. The king said, no, we didn't do it. And now we find out, oops. I guess we were interrogating him a little too hard.
Right. Well, I predicted that one yesterday. I used to live in Saudi Arabia, as in Jeddah. And I predicted to a friend of mine yesterday, they will finally, eventually, probably admit, and then it kind of went haywire, and then this guy was a bad rogue guy, and now we're going to go chop his head off in Saudi Arabia. Shame on you, even though it was ordered by MBS, as they call him, the crown prince, in Saudi Arabia. What tickled me the most, though, today, when I was reading, trying to prepare for the rest of the stations in your show tonight, when I was reading about the call to the king. When the king hung up the phone in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, he probably turned around and said, I just talked to Hillary Clinton. The king has dementia.
Okay.
The king of Saudi Arabia has dementia. And for the White House to say, the king said, honestly, we all know that. Everybody in the media knows that. Everybody in the kingdom knows that. And, dementia is a serious thing. I have family members that have it. But what I'm trying to say here is this. Clearly, the king probably didn't even know who he was talking to. And now they're quoting the king says. I just found that absolutely ridiculous.
Well, he can't lie.
Right. I found it ridiculous.
I'm sure he couldn't have the order. But this is one of those things where, it just looks like Trump was being played the fool. I mean, because he's out there saying, no, they deny it emphatically. No, maybe it was rogue actors. Maybe he should have just shut his mouth and said, we don't know, but we're looking into it. I don't know why we have to go deeper into, we don't know. We're looking into it.
There's a long history here with, if you look at presidents, the crown prince, MBS as he's called, he really dressed down President Obama at an event overseas, in the sense of he was telling him about how the kingdom has to operate and on and on and on, because he's brazen. He's a prince. He's got, a $90 million home. And so he thinks he can talk down to people, as he did to President Obama at the time. And, Bush, of course, and his brother had a connection to the Saudi money. And then President Trump, you know, in the history of I think the Saudis had some loans out there and things. So Saudi Arabia's always used its money, yeah. And they've got they had the business connections. And so that's a whole different world there. But, you know, the Arab world, especially with Saudi Arabia throwing the money around, they believe they can get away with murder.
Yeah, well, they can't because, look, what are they going to do? What are we going to do to them? I mean, at the end of the day, someone asked me today, you know, well, fine. So let's say they chop his head off and they kill him. What are they going to do? What are we going to do? We didn't do anything after 9/11. What are we going to do over this?
Right. We flew the entire bin Laden family out within 2 hours out of the country.
Exactly. I mean, come on. I mean, nothing's going to happen here. There'll be a little ruffled feathers for a second, and it will be long forgotten. Right. And again, they're going to get away with it because, oh, by the way, we've got to sell them more guns.
Yeah, and oil, and et cetera.
Yeah, well, hey, who knows? Maybe a change of administration might be helpful. I doubt it, but you never know. But found something interesting today. Evidently, Elizabeth Warren actually did take a DNA test. Are you surprised by that?
I think she shouldn't have. Personally.
No, that's stupid.
Yeah. Because, hey, look, here's the bottom line. She's 1,024th and 1/32nd. I'm 2%. I've had my DNA done. I'm 2% of what they're telling me is probably a Jewish diaspora in the Mideast. I'm 2%. So technically, I have a little bit more legitimacy to say I'm Jewish than she does Native American. Now, you know, any amount of blood in somebody, you know, from a heritage is something to be proud of, first of all. So, you know, that's something to be proud of. My children are part Native American, okay? Because their mom was part Native American. But I think that's something to be proud of. The problem is that I don't think she should have taken a test, first of all. And now it's 1 in 1,024. She's just not going to win anything off of this.
No. And I go back. I always go back to what Lyndon Johnson used to say. You know, if you're explaining, you're losing. I think the thing was is he said he wanted to claim somebody was having sex with a bull just to hear them just to hear them deny it.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, technically she is Native American. That's great, and again, that's something to be proud of. But it is so minuscule in the DNA structure there that it's just she's not going to gain anything from it. Yeah. Now, he's not going to pay the $1 million either, he promised.
No, of course not. Does he have it? That's the other question.
Well, he's not going to pay it if he does.
But here, I guess this really shows she's in. You know, all that talk of I'm not running for, this shows me she's in. This is a I want to be president moment.
Right. That's true.
Her and everybody else.
Well, they were going to keep their powder dry. Everybody in D.C. knew that, Rick. And then, as you know, one starts out front and the other's like, oh, we got to go.
Yep.
Although I would caution, the out front person may be the lone person standing there that doesn't make it. Just ask Jeb Bush.
Yeah. Well, I don't think Joe Biden's going to be the guy. A lot of my mm-hmm. friends are. And originally you asked me a year ago, did I think Joe Biden would be out in front? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the Me Too thing is going to swallow him up.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's got way too many Me Too moments.
Mm-hmm. He's different. I mean, I know him. I serve with him. He's what, how do I say this? I want to be kind because I really, really like Joe Biden. I mean, a lot. I think he's a wonderful person. I really do. But he lived in a time when you could be, and it's not sexual assault or anything, but he lived in a time in politics where you could be a bit gregarious.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you could be. And today you can't be.
Yeah, but we're not forgiving that era of you used to be able to get away with it anymore.
Exactly. And again, it's not sexual assault or anything like that, but just the idea you put your arm around somebody or something in today's different world.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like George H.W. Bush, you know, giving one of the singers a little pat on the behind.
Mm-hmm.
Used to be able to get away with that. How come you can't pat him on the behind anymore?
Well, not now. Right. That's correct.
Yeah, well, it is what it is. And finally, evidently, there's a lawsuit claiming that Harvard is discriminating. This has been going on for a while, hasn't it? The Asians have been claiming it. We're so smart, they don't want us there?
Well, yes. Now, there's a little bit of hidden agenda on this one, though. Half of the Asian community that's looking at this issue is not for doing anything, and half are for doing something. And the groups that have been kind of sponsoring this legally are groups that want to do away with affirmative action.
Mm.
So they're funding the Asians who want to take this into the lawsuit realm. They're funding them, hoping maybe the lawsuit then will do away with affirmative action.
Ah, interesting.
Right? That, yeah, there's a little bit of hidden stuff to it.
Interesting ploy where you could probably get the Republicans on board with that.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Interesting stuff. Yeah. Anyway, good stuff, Bob. I appreciate
Thank
the time.
You. Okay, thanks.
As always, our good friend Bob Nay, Talk Media News. Quick break, right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.